Welcome to The Ether. Today is Monday, January 31st, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by Talus. Talus Protocol is the NFT platform for independent artists on Terra. Talus helps to provide artists with the tools and resources needed to transition from traditional art into the NFT world. With their V1 launch coming soon, Talus will be the place to see real-world art reflected on Terra. Be sure to join their Telegram and follow Talus on Twitter for updates on their roadmap, Validator, and other Talus news. Find your next favorite artist on talus.art. This episode of Ether is also brought to you by WeFund. WeFund is a community crowdfunding cross-chain incubator on Terra and is the first launchpad that implements a milestone funding release system to protect investors. All money raised for projects is deposited in Anchor Protocol and is refundable, and all decisions are based on community voting power. WeFund is community-focused and designed to be a user-friendly experience for both project creators and investors. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the Telegram for more information. Links are in the show notes. Check them out online at WeFund.app. Terra Spaces appreciates the support of all our sponsors. Today on The Ether, we have part one of a two-part CeFi space, Prism, Sports, Liquidation, and FUD. Let's take a listen.
Hey guys, good evening. If anyone wants to raise their hands to hang out, co-host, and shit like that, go right ahead. Just hit the speaker button or whatever, and I'll add you on. Wait a couple minutes for people to hop on. A lot of interesting lessons from this last week worth learning about. Hey, Yak, what you doing?
Oh, not much, man. I can't stay for long, unfortunately, but I just wanted to celebrate with you guys. And also thank you, Seffy, for teaching me about dynamic DCA. I use that to great effect on this downturn or this correction, whatever you want to call it. Was buying all the way down at the bottom. My biggest buys were at the bottom. And when I saw the news like an hour ago with the announcement, I mean, this is like, to me, my background is in marketing. This feels like genuinely like such a great idea and such a great development. And I think that the way Terraform Labs is thinking about marketing Terra is like just right on, like this mainstream marketing adoption. I did another market buy as soon as I saw it. And yeah, I'm just feeling great now.
It's not unlike, Litecoin did this a number of years ago. I forget what year it was, maybe like 2018 or something like that. And I think somehow or another, either Litecoin Foundation or someone associated them, someone paid for some ads. So it does definitely add a lot of visibility. And of course, Litecoin stayed at, pretty high in market cap for a number of years, as you know. But I'm not sure fully how I feel about it, but it can't really hurt because it's just more visibility. It is a popular thing right now. I think crypto.com has their thing. StormX is with Portland Trailblazers. Voyager is with the Dallas Mavericks. So, and then there's some other ones too. I'm blanking on right now as far as like, I think maybe FTX or anyway, a bunch of sports partnerships are actually happening, along the way. So, I'm not sure how crowded that gets, but it definitely creates public saturation for just crypto in general. So it's probably like any crypto related marketing is probably good for all crypto to some extent, huh?
Yeah, I would think so. And if they can somehow, I don't know if this is possible, but if they can somehow through like Alice or something incorporate payments with UST for certain things, even if it's just kind of almost gimmicky, where it's like some,
food product there that you can buy with UST, and that's the only thing you can buy or whatever. Like, I'm sure the knock-on effects of like additional press and whatnot that is going to be generated if this passes and these kinds of things start happening are going to be, you know, phenomenal. So yeah, I love the fact that they're thinking about like a 5-year deal versus like a 1-season deal. Like, just the, I like the fact that they are thinking on a big, you know, big picture, big scope, like big swings. You know, that's the kind of thing that, from my background and my experience, it really does matter. Like, when you take big swings and think it in like really big terms, it's really exciting.
The other thing you got to do is you have to saturate the political class ultimately, because, you know, in crypto, if people are worried about, you know, legislation and regulations and what have you, it becomes all a moot point when all of the people that are the so-called regulators and all the people that are in the government are actually using crypto already. It's sort of like the same thing with like cell phones and encryption, where on the one hand, you know, there's like some people that want to sort of like not ban cell phones, but, you know, like reduce your access to encryption. But then like the moment politicians are using these things, they're like, well, we don't want that to happen, right? Because then their own data gets affected. So it's really about just, you know, we're basically on that. That's what we talk about a lot, is the path to saturation, which is where, you know, global adoption and just cultural saturation happens with crypto. So it is important to sort of like win hearts and minds fairly early. I think that's true for Terra as well as just, you know, any platform. But especially because if they're doing a US-based sports team, that could be helpful, because Terra hasn't had as much US-based like exposure because it wasn't on very many exchanges. I know in Terra spaces, we tend to have a lot of Americans and stuff, because I guess a lot of Americans use Twitter. But like, you know, from the standpoint of Luna itself, like, it wasn't available until like, you know, really this last year. And so it was a little bit slow in the uptake, in my view, in terms of in the eyes of Americans and also YouTubers and such. But anyway, yeah. So the exponential sort of buying strategy, like how much did you buy, or approximately in what ratio, if you don't mind me asking, like, what did you do?
So I just did powers of two, basically. So I did, you know, 1, 2, 4, 16. That's as far as I got, basically. And I was buying, I didn't catch the total bottom, but yeah, I made my biggest buy up until about an hour ago, at like 44 or 50. I got lucky, you know, I just set the limit there. But I actually made my biggest buy as soon as I saw the tweet from Doe and read the, so about an hour and a half ago, I bought the most Luna I've ever bought. But that's just, you know, I'm.
So you bought the news and figured Reddit, huh?
Yeah, we'll see what happens. You know, maybe I wake up tomorrow and I'm not so happy. But ultimately, I think these are the kinds of things that I love seeing, because they represent, to me, they represent like moves to integrate DeFi into the quote unquote real world. And so these are the kinds of things that make me more bullish overall, you know, about Terra, regardless of like the dynamic DCA. But I will say, like, that, like, learning about that from you has been a complete and total game changer for me. I started with Lunomic strategy, which is, you know, phenomenal, but when I saw the market turning, I kind of pivoted and, you know, sold all my Luna and just kind of went into stables and got out at about 85, and then just looked into your strategy, kind of familiarized myself with it more, looked at all the other strategies, and just kind of decided on the dynamic DCA as the best way to scale back in. And it's just been working really well.
Yeah, and there's several ways to sort of implement that, by the way. There's, of course, you can pick like a scale, for example, you know, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, kind of like that, where you do kind of a multiples of 2. You could do multiples of 3 also, which would be even more conservative. Conservative meaning that most of your cash is preserved for the very like bottom that you could catch. And then how aggressive you are also depends on what percentage your grid is set up at, right? So if a coin starts at 100 and you're doing every 10% down, then that's one way to do it. Or if you are like buying every 5% down, that's more aggressive, right? So if you're going to tighten up the grid, like do 5% increments as your limit orders, you could then do maybe like multiples of three, perhaps, so that you're being more aggressive, you know, farther down. But it's all sort of an estimation based on your intuition as far as how far price can fall, right? Like, you know, is it probable that Luna drops below its like ultra high volume floor at about $40? It's not very probable, and it didn't fall. That's probably the reason why, because there's a huge amount of like, you know, volume profile there. So you could argue that, like, let's say someone sold at the top or was buying at the top, like at 100, they could like make their grid between 100 and 40. And you may not hit, you know, every part of that, but the whole point of that strategy is more for being conservative with your money, not necessarily like, you know, getting the perfect buy every time or necessarily automatically hitting the very bottom. The other thing I find that's helpful on Terra that is not the case on any other chain, at least for right now, is that you can get these kind of just wild free sort of bonded Luna arbs, which is just insane. So like when Luna was like around what in the, I think high 40s or mid 40s this time, there was almost like a 4% arb rate between Luna to be Luna. So not only did you like buy exponentially at the bottom, you were actually able to get a lot more at the bottom because you're getting that discount. You know, you could have had Kujira bids, I suppose, and some of those hit, but I don't like the loss of control with Kujira, where, like, let's say I think we're getting closer and closer to the bottom, and what if Kujira's bid doesn't hit? Then I'm just like wasting my time, right? Because on the way up, you're definitely not going to hit a Kujira bid, right? So I kind of figure, well, if the arb rate is a good 3-4% discount anyway, and I'm already at a pretty deep bottom, I might as well just go for it. So that's kind of how I looked at that. And
yep.
Yeah, and I didn't sell the top. Maybe I'm an idiot, but like I didn't sell at all. What I did is I just sort of started a new position from the top down, because I don't know when, for example, like redacted news is going to come out, right? So I don't want to risk not being in Luna on the way up, even if I might make a mistake of maybe, you know, not selling at the top or something like that, right? So that's kind of how I look at it.
100%. I mean, I think I just got really lucky this time because I drew my, you know, Fibonacci retracements and I am not typically a TA guy. And this time I just happened to like see it touch the resistance line and was like, you know, I had some other thoughts. I was actually thinking about MIM and the interaction between Wonderland and Abracadabra. I was actually thinking about that. I look back in my Discord messages. I have like this little private group that I belong to. And on the 8th of January, I was like telling these guys, like, I don't know, I'm not feeling so great about this connection between MIM and UST and Wonderland. and I called it in a weird way. I think it was just lucky, but ultimately I got out, I got into stables and yeah, you're right. There's like multiple ways of doing it. I think that,
well, the FUD, you know, is interesting because I think there are two forms of FUD going around. One was that, oh no, the anchor reserve, you know, like that's going to do anything to the price of Luna, really. And then the second was, you know, functionally, you know, what could happen to MIM's, you know, UST or whatever. I mean, the Abracadabra's UST, and is that going to flood the market and cause a problem, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, there is a little bit of uncertainty there. And, you know, crypto does tend to sell off on sentiment. And when you have so much leverage in the system, then sentiment can lead to cascade and then you can get a big drop. So the thing is, like, all of that is somewhat, yeah, like you said, there's an element of luck to it. It's fairly unpredictable, though. Like, I have seen things go the opposite direction many, many times with Bitcoin and other situations where, like, you think you're going to, you know, like plan the perfect, you know, sell and the buy, but it can be really hard to tell. And what I like about the dynamic DCA buying into it is that you don't need to know where the bottom is at that point. You just have to sort of plan for a high depth bottom and just keep buying. And then, you know, you just have to be comfortable with, you know, not, you know, if you miss the bottom or whatever, you didn't buy enough, and it goes up again, well, then so be it, I guess. But, you know, really for right now, for the foreseeable future, we're really in what I consider, like, you know, ultra high volatility, early adoption territory. And it's just as easy for price to sort of fly without you and you not being on the sort of plane and as it is for, you know, like, so yeah, optimizing the buys in terms of timing the market's really difficult, but.
Yeah, no, that's great. And one other thing I wanted to say to anybody who's listening, like, this RB Telegram bot, like, I said it during these drops, you know, these pretty intense days where we were having significant drops and the R between Luna and B Luna was growing. Like, I set it to only trigger at 3.5% or greater. And I was able to pick up a lot of Luna and convert it to B Luna on these drops at like a 3.5, or like you said, I think it got almost up to, I think it was like 3.8 was the best I got. And that's just phenomenal. I mean, that is, you know,
what was happening there. What the reason why that happens is because people were moving quickly from bonded Luna to Luna. And what ended up happening was, is that that's what creates that arbitrage opportunity in the other direction. There weren't that many people sort of buying Luna and moving to bonded Luna. These were all people trying to like cover their LTVs. What they were doing was people are extracting their bonded Luna out as collateral, but then they realize, hey, you know what? If I just provide B Luna, well, I mean, my B Luna is not enough to cover my LTV. I don't want to get liquidated. So I'm going to sell at the 4% discount, which is crazy. And then they're going and supplying that UST to protect they're trying to protect their LTV with the UST, right? So that whole thing just reeks of just terrible planning for the most part, which I think a lot of people are doing, which is why they're in that rush. And clearly, you know, these are not all people that are like listening to spaces like this and sort of sorting their shit out. A lot of people are getting liquidated and they're not realizing how fast the liquidations can occur. So back in May of last year, if you guys were here, or some of you guys are probably here. What happened was at the time, Anchor wasn't quite as responsive with Columbus 4. The Terra blockchain wasn't as responsive and sort of a mixture of events. Oh, and also the LTV was different. I forget what the number was. I think it was like a 50% top line LTV or something. Anyway, there's a lot of different things that were going on and there wasn't a lot of buffer there. And a lot of people got liquidated big time when Luna fell from like, I think $16 down to like $5 or something, and then kind of dragged for a while. So, you know, that liquidation period was when sort of I first bought a lot. You know, I kind of first bought at 16, I think then 12, maybe 5, and went in really heavy. But that was kind of a lesson to be learned about the fact that really with Terra, you have two forms of leverage. You have Anchor leverage, and then you have like Luna leverage on various exchanges, which is increasing, by the way. There's more and more platforms that have Luna now, which you can buy and you can trade on leverage, you know, both shorts and longs. So what you end up getting is the more leverage is in the system, at some point that leverage has to be unwound. And there's different ways that gets unwound. One is you can have a basically cascading liquidation downward, liquidating long positions. You can, on the way down, you also tend to hit people's stop losses if people have trailing stops. And some robotic platforms have like trailing stops. So for example, if I bought Luna today at $50, but I don't want to lose my money if it drops below $50, then I put a trailing stop in. And as the price of Luna goes up, the stop loss also rises simultaneously. So for example, if Luna's price is $54 now, maybe the trailing stop loss will go to 53. So basically it's trailing, meaning that the stop loss keeps moving. But the more stop losses you have on the way down, that just essentially equates to sell orders while the price is dropping. So other things that happen is, you know, leverage long positions or even anchor loans, which essentially constitute the same thing. What you end up getting is you get a price ceiling, sort of, because at some point people say, wait a minute, I'm up 100%. I need to sort of take some of this and pay down my loan. So what they'll do is they'll sell some of that on the way up and then maybe pay their loan potentially. So that also leverage positions on the long side have a tendency to prevent the price to the upside at some level or the other, because those positions have to be unwound either through you know, liquidations or by sell orders at the top, right? So that'd be a reason why, for example, with Bitcoin during this last year's sort of like double peak bull run type of thing, you got really high velocity all the way to the top in terms of just the number of people that took on leverage. And then you had like a crushing drop from like 65,000 to, you know, 30,000 or whatever it was. I forget the number, but basically you had this huge drop because the leverage positions get unwound. And then, as if people didn't have enough punishment, they did it again and sent Bitcoin back to, you know, 67K or whatever it was. And, you know, some of that was just people that already were in profit and then just bought back down below, of course. And then other people, there's new entrants to the market. So what that, you know, what all of that creates is really high volatility, but it also creates the opportunity for fresh people to show up and buy low, right? So it's actually really good when you have very high velocity corrections. When people post bearish nonsense like, oh, you know, I thought Terra was the next best, you know, thing since sliced bread. How come it dropped 60%? Like, you know, Ponzi scheme or whatever. That's just based on amateurs that don't know what they're doing, basically. Like, that's just tells me, okay, you're new to crypto and you're an idiot. and not only that, but those are the exact same people that are going to get wrecked because they have no idea what they're doing, right? So they're the same people that won't buy the bottoms too. And I talk about this a lot. You know, during crypto bottoms, almost nobody's buying. Like, that's very common. It's also noticeable a lot of times in the volume, profiles and everything. You'll see a big volume spike due to the, like capitulation and also the liquidations. But as far as like the buying at the very bottom, I mean, like, I'm like there looking at myself in the mirror, just basically just ripping everyone off buying the very bottoms, because I have money waiting to do so. So like, that's why I kind of tell folks, like, always have some money ready. Don't always be sort of all in all the time when it comes to crypto, no matter how bullish you are and all that. And if that means that some people need to sell, you know, along the way, then they need to sell along the way. That just, they can do whatever they want. I don't really like shame people for selling or whatever. I don't give a shit what you do with your money, quite frankly. So that's kind of a way to think about it. You always kind of want to keep some capital ready to deploy for interesting buys. So just a way to think about it. But at the same time, there's also nothing wrong with just buying and staking and holding and auto compounding. Like, you know, if you're making a good solid, you know, 8% auto compounding the next couple of years and maybe 5% after that, that's still a lot of money over 10 years, right? It's not even like a joke how much money that actually is. So, you know, most people probably shouldn't trade and should just sort of hold auto compound and call it a day. But anyway, that's just kind of my thoughts on the sort of like this liquidation event and whatnot. You can use the FUD, you know, and you could try to play that game. Like, for example, you know, sell on FUD, you know, buy on redacted news or whatever. And that's fine too. Like, it's certainly an option for people to do. But what I'm saying is that sort of thing is not very predictable. I prefer generally more mathematically, like, perfect strategies where I never lose. And I know that I have a strategy to always be adding along the way. And that's why I kind of keep my day job as well, so that like I have capital coming in every month and I can use that to invest in things or whatever. Phil, what's up? You there?
Yeah, what's up? I'm out with a mask on right now. I don't know if you can hear me well. How's everyone doing?
Okay. Everyone's doing well. Good, good. Yeah, anything special going on with you?
No, this has been a typical, like, like learning experience, this whole DIFF thing. I love when this stuff happens because this is when you really get to see like unique circumstances or rare circumstances, and you get to like examine the market and what happens. So I'm loving this.
Yeah, you always want to learn something from it. One thing is, technically speaking, by the way, you know, we've dipped this time more than 50%. So there's a couple of things to think about when that happens. One thing is, number one, from a technical analysis perspective, you could draw a whole nother fib retracement extension, you know, from like, what is 103 down to like, I don't know, $43 or something like that. And that would give you a new set of extensions to follow. So a lot of people trade off of those kinds of, you know, swing lows, as they're called.
I don't know if that correlates with the 55% drawdowns that I've mentioned, but I mostly like work by my own observations because I trust them more. And like 55%+ drawdowns in crypto are extremely common.
Yeah.
I think that's because it goes a little bit over 50% where everyone's hoping it stops. It's always like a little, that psychological point where you're like, oh my God, it can't go any further. And it always goes like a little past that. And that's where.
Yeah. Although that's tricky, you know, like the Bitcoin run from like 20, let me think. The Bitcoin run from like, you know, like a couple thousand bucks to $20,000. Had I think 7 drops, and they were all about 40%. So there was this kind of like, not meme, but pattern established where the thought process was, you know, if you dropped more than 40%, you know, like 45 or 50, then, you know, hold on, we're fucked, it's bear market time. That kind of became the thing.
Right.
And that's sort of what played out. Like the drop from 20,000 downward, I think it was like to 12K or something, or maybe less, 8K. I don't remember. It was a hideous drop. And that was like, you know, that was sort of like the harbinger of, you know, the bearish market. So the thing about these big drops is, you know, when they start getting under 50%, they do make people nervous. And in this particular case, we dropped to the 200-day moving average. But what I was getting at on the Fibonacci extensions is, though, remember the extension is not the retracement. It's the extension that you draw that extends from the retracement. So when you pull down.
So I'm not totally sure.
So when you pull up TradingView and you use a little pull down tool, you would go from like $103 and you do a little like, you draw a line down to $43. And what that'll do is it won't just show you the Fibonacci retracement levels. It'll show you the extensions above the all-time high. So that's kind of one of the most useful tools in crypto, if there's ever a tool at all.
Can you explain this briefly, like what a Fibonacci extension is, just for everyone listening?
So if you, one is, if someone wants to do this, just hop on to tradingview.com. And you can use the free, retracement extension tool is actually basically free. And what you do is, fib levels are essentially just sort of mathematically derived ratio levels, to keep it simple, between two different price points. And typically these correlate to some extent with psychological behavior, but also have become standard sort of among technical traders as sort of like price levels that, you know, that a lot of people place their buys and sells and stop losses and short and long positions and whatnot on. Okay. So there's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy to these things, in the sense that, like, if, you know, millions of traders around the world are doing the same thing, that, you know, there is some level of like repeatability to it. So it's somewhat reliable in that respect. But what you do is, so, for example, in Luna's case, the biggest drop in Luna's price was from $3 down to about $4. So that represented a massive, what we call, swing low. And you won't know exactly how to draw this the moment, like you have to wait for a few weeks to be sure that that is in fact the low, because, you know, it may take a month or two to even know in the retrospectoscope whether that was even the low, right? But once you've established that and you've gone a certain, you know, let's say a month or two into the future, then you know for sure that's a low, or you're pretty sure. Then what happens is you can draw a retracement. And what the extension tool does is it not only draws a Fibonacci retracement, which is levels from the top down to the bottom that you just formed, but it also draws a series of lines past the all-time high that predict probable price levels that are going to represent what they call Fibonacci resistance. And they make sense psychologically in the sense that, like, all right, you know, there are certain sort of like ratios at which point people are probably going to sell from a psychological standpoint. Because, you know, as price rises,
I always joke about 69 and like it keeps playing out. The 69 is an actual psychological number.
Well, 60s well, let me tell you, on the Luna chart, actually, it's right at 68.6 by my sort of like more precise calculation.
That is 69, sir.
So it's 69, exactly. So that's where that comes from, maybe. Is that you see a lot of volume there because you'll have a lot of sell orders at those levels. You'll have, and then you'll have like amateurs who are selling at 70, right? You know, so
and like, you have a lot of people front run like okay, like I think everyone's going to sell at 70, so you get orders at like 69.5,
exactly,
or 68.5, right? Or whatever.
So, yeah, or yeah, exactly. So all of that sort of plays an approximation role. So yeah, there's different ways to look at it, but. The way you have to think about this is, okay, wait, like if we're going to have sell orders somewhere and we're going to have buy orders somewhere, where are these likely to be, right? You don't have to be perfect. You just have to realize, well, humans tend to like even numbers. There are some studies where people like the number, that people tend to have higher trading volume at like 7 and 3, by the way, like $70 and $30. So those might have some just psychological impact. Who knows?
Humans love 69.
Yeah, and then 69. So anyway, but the Fibonacci extensions, they're drawn from major drops. And this might constitute one that's deep enough. You could draw like a new set of extensions and get some more like precision targets. But the extension target for Luna past all-time high that comes first is like the chart I always post, and that's right at about $135. And then after that, it's like 218 and then 280, something like that, right? So when I posted this chart, recall, like I have had this exact same chart as far as Fib extensions since, let's see, May.
So long.
Since June of last year. I haven't changed it, right? It's been literally the exact same. I just locked it and it just stays that way. And it's been fairly, the levels have been fairly predictive as far as like general targets of resistance and support. And when people say, well, it doesn't like, you know, it doesn't abide by it perfectly. Well, no, of course it doesn't, because it won't abide by it perfectly. And the reason is because number one, you're looking at the chart afterwards, not in real time. In real time, when you're watching those levels, right, you'll see price hit those levels and stop. And you'll see sell orders and volume happen, right? So you'll
this
see
is very profound wisdom right here.
you sort of call it astrology to some extent, but when you watch it in real time, it's not exactly fully astrology. You'll see people behave according to these lines, and you can set sell orders at every single Fib level if you want. I think the Cadena one, I kind of had like $25-26, and it hit 27, right? People are like, why in the world would it go that high? Well, there it did, right? So like the thing is, these extensions give you wild numbers. You're like, wait a minute, like, what do you mean like Luna can go to $1,200? I'm like, yeah, well, that's just normal. That's just how Fib extensions work. And what you'll do, and one of the most instructive things to do actually is to draw a set yourself. Because what happens is you'll notice that the deeper the drop in price, the higher the Fib extensions go, right? Like it's like a spring that you open up. Like the farther you pull down that tool, the depth of the drop, you know, when Luna went from like $22 to $4, you might think, hey, wait a minute, that's really bearish. That's a pump and dump. Why in the world would you buy this thing, right? But so number one, fundamentals have to be intact. You can't just buy everything in this way, right? But assuming the fundamentals of a coin are good, you believe in what it does, then those deep retracements actually lead to really, really wide, very high extensions. And what you'll notice is only in the early life of a coin can you get like that kind of price velocity, right? Where it goes from like $23 down to $5 or $4. And that leads to just wild high extensions, right? So what does that imply mathematically? It implies extraordinary amounts of capital velocity. It implies a huge amount of human interest in buying this thing, right? To drive it to a mega bubble. It implies a lot of people taking on potentially leverage. And in that case, at that time, was Anchor, right? So the availability of all of these sort of factors drives that capital velocity. And that tells you that you're probably going to moon the next time this goes up. And of course, from $5, we went to $100 as expected. Like, that's all just normal at that point, right? So, you know, like, it's just normal. I don't know what else to say. Like, it seems crazy. It's like, why in the world would it 20x? But it just would. Like, that's just the nature of these things when you're talking about adoption.
Near thinking is pretty hard to explain. I don't know if this is a good time to go into it, but like you'll never be able to think linear or exponentially, because that's not how your brain works. So it's very difficult.
Yeah, it's more like biological math that does this, right? Like viral growth and whatnot. So you don't think about this from this perspective of like the average stock, because a stock's price is not priced in this way, right? It's not like direct adoption and price appreciation is reflected in crypto in the most purest form. Whereas in a stock price, you have all sorts of shenanigans and bullshit that play in the background.
Yeah, and human brain also, they say, thinks linearly. You might know more about this than I do, but like it seems to be true. Like if you like a good example is like if you ask someone if you could theoretically fold a piece of paper 52 times, like how thick, what would the thickness be or whatever? And right. most people guess around 2 inches, but it would approximately reach to the sun.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, the exponential nature of things is hard to grasp, but also the idea of like crypto assets and their velocity is just hard to grasp for people, you know. And this is also the reason why, by the way, on the downside, right, like you can imagine what my portfolio has done with Luna going from 100 down to $40. Right, it would basically take, you know, most people's breath away, and you know, it's a big drop. And you know, the thing is, like, I was comfortable with that drop the moment I bought at five, because what I was looking for was for it to reach, you know, high velocity, you know, make it up to like, you know, these super high levels, and then I was fully expecting it to drop again after that happened, and that's I just consider that normal, and it's fine. So I never intended to try to time the top, because I know the top can't be timed in the way you think it can. And what will happen is in crypto is you don't take an asset that you've spent so much time researching and that you know almost for sure is going to do well and then just wreck yourself over trading. Yeah, that's a dangerous thing.
Thank you for saying that. People are just like, you can't get attached or married to an asset. It's like, look, I spent probably 10,000 hours this year learning about that.
The fuck you can't, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Conviction, the conviction buy that you marry is by definition what you should do. Like, the people that say otherwise just don't know the fuck they're doing. That's the bottom line. Like, that's really what they're talking about. I don't really know what I'm talking about. I don't know what the asset is.
Yeah, and they're really frustrated that they lost their money.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that they shouldn't even own that they do, right? But they don't even know why they own them. They just sort of like try to make money. So the conviction buy, I think, is really hard to come by. And really, quite frankly, to have high conviction, you have to have a high level of technical knowledge, I think. I think the reality is most people, what they're going to do is they're going to buy, let's say they bought Luna at like, you know, oh my God, I bought it at $16. It went to five. What they're going to do is they're going to sell somewhere down below, you know, as it falls, because that seems like an extraordinarily, you know, big deal to lose that, you know, quote unquote, lose that much money, right?
Yeah, so it's a lot of doubt, really.
Yeah, when you don't realize in crypto, that's like, you know, 4 to 6 months is like in an early cycle asset with high fundamentals, like 6 months is all it takes to sort of be not only back to prior high, but like be right past it pretty quickly. So,
and the moment that you always lose money, if you think about it, is always the moment that you doubt your convictions. You're like, oh, but what if I was wrong? Oh my God, I just got wrecked because I made the wrong decision.
Right. Well, you'll miss the big, big future ahead, and you'll unnecessarily overthink things. Because, you know, what ends up happening too is when you deal in crypto, the other psychological problem that you end up facing is a lot of people will get a big gain at some point, right? And they'll have a big drop after they have that big gain. So they'll do a 10x, like, oh my God, I made my first 10x. And then they didn't sell or whatever it is that they thought they should have done. And then it'll drop like 50%. And they're like, shit, I could have bought a Lambo, right? That's how they think. So what ends up happening is you start getting into a lottery mentality. And what you end up doing is you create mistakes in the future. And the way that happens is, and that Bitcoin chart and Ethereum chart that I posted recently from early in the course of those coins, is that, like, you know, when BTC dropped from, like, you know, $100 to $40 and then subsequently heads off to like $1,200, right? Like, you know, that was, or I forget the exact numbers, but the point is, you know, it had a 12x, you know, from that point. And like, I did a quick survey of people to see what they would have done. I hid the name Bitcoin. And I said, like, you know, would you buy here? Would you sell here? And would you hold or whatever? And, you know, there's nothing specific about the chart except for the fact that it has high velocity from the bottom to where, you know, the part of the chart that I posted. And a lot of people are like, oh, it looks like a pump and dump, I'm going to sell. Well, exactly right. Like, that's what most people are going to do. They start looking at charts and they don't realize how they work. They don't sort of,
yeah, hindsight's always going to be 2020. You're never going to do it.
Well, not only that, but like, people don't, when people first start doing technical like things, because by the way, as soon as you start losing some money in crypto, or by losing, you know, you're down, all of a sudden everyone starts becoming the researcher, right? They're like, look, figuring out how to do technical analysis, try to figure out how they fucked up, figure out what they could have done.
Tony Bott comes back. He hasn't been here since 2017. He fucking came back.
So people, that's what people do. Like, they want to start researching after the fact. And then what happens is, they'll go in there and go, okay, the first mistake they make is on a logarithmic growth chart, they use a linear like chart. So like, you'll go on TradingView, and for crypto, you generally want to be on the log scale. When I see people on the linear scale, I think, well, they're just trading in it for the short term. But you know, the magnitude of the ups and downs looks really big on the linear scale. It's like, oh my God, look, it looks like a big parabolic move. And like, you know, like, you would have missed, say, for example, Luna $5 to $100 if you didn't understand that these things can 20x in no time on a cycle one sort of move, right? Or cycle three, well, whatever it is,
I mean, that time. 25% today, like in how much time? We're up 25% or whatever. Like, it's insane.
Exactly. Well, that's another thing too, by the way, because if you think about it mathematically, if you're in an asset that can grow exponentially, there is no obvious reason why you shouldn't be buying exponentially down the price. That's kind of what I learned over the years.
Because all your downside, like, is amplified to the upside in the same way.
Exactly. Now, this won't work in like some shit stock or, you know, some garbage pump and dump coin where, you know, you just buy exponentially the bottom and it goes to zero. So, like, in other words, am I doing this? I know someone joked on StockTwits. They're like, oh, yeah, you know, like, you claim to do this exponential buying thing, but what happened to your Nexus token that you mentioned? And I'm like, well, fuck, dude, I didn't buy, like, you know, $100 million of Nexus token, dude. Like, I bought $1,000 worth. And I'm just playing with it, right? Like, so the idea that somehow every token is the same and that you're going to exert the same amount of, like, you know, capital for everything you buy is ludicrous. I mean, obviously, I don't do that for everything. You'd have to be an idiot, right? Like, so there is an element of, preserving most of your capital for the most like high probability, high conviction sort of plays.
I mean, I hate on gambling, but every human, I think, loves a little gambling, you know? Like,
yeah, of course.
The smartest, you know, you spend $50 on like a dumb coin once in a while.
Oh, yeah. That also, yeah, I was going to mention, yeah, the psychological thing I forgot to tell you people do wrong. So what happens is after people have been wrecked a couple of times, then they get into the disbelief stage. I heard a buddy of mine saying it today. He's like, oh, yeah, you know what? All right, dude. Next time it goes to, you know, $100, I'm going to sell this time. I'm like, dude, if it goes back to $100, you just leave it the fuck alone. You don't sell it then. That doesn't make any
sense. Right at the time you shouldn't, the next time.
Yeah, because in crypto, generally, like a return to all-time high is a tendency for, you know, breakout past all-time high. Now, actually, that has not been as true this year as it has been in other years, by the way. If you look at like Adam's chart is a great example. The number of times it did like a double and triple top has been ridiculous. I mean, it's interesting how many like people are trying to front run each other to sell. So
I'm so glad I bailed out of Adam for Luna, because God, that would just be stressful to like try and like play. Like, I love Adam and all, yeah. But yeah.
it's interesting how it just goes up and down and up and down. It was a great grid trading coin, actually, because it just goes, it's so volatile, right?
Tell me more. Anyway,
But like at the same time, you couldn't have predicted that like ahead of time that it would have done this. But basically, when something, you know, gets back to a prior all-time high, like when BTC hit 20,000 again, like I bought a lot more Bitcoin because like it's going to go up. That's just what's going to happen. It's basically the way you look at a, especially in a long time frame, like over like a year.
It's like buying winners, right? Like you're like you buy winners if you're buying all time highs. It's a really good strategy that people don't understand. By the way, is you could literally only buy all time highs and you would
and
make
do
a
pretty
crap
well.
Load of money.
Like, yeah, that's the cup and handle concept. And there's actually even a website called like cupandhandlecharts.com or some shit, and it'll give you alerts and everything if you're interested in stocks or whatever. But what it does is it the implication is that if you do a like cup formation over a like a one, like the longer the time frame the better, like 6 months to a year, for example, assuming of course the company fundamentals are decent, your coin fundamentals, whatever it is you're buying, and you do a cup formation, sometimes you'll have another dip there because everyone's like market makers are like, okay, these idiots are gonna all, you know, buy here anyway,
so we'll long term enough, so we're gonna take their
money. But the market makers can dump their bags there and then buy them again a little bit lower. So you get like a cup and handle kind of maneuver going, but basically a cup or a cup and handles type of maneuver, when you go back to all hot time highs twice, once or twice, you're usually going to break at that point. And so a lot of people will jump in and you'll see a big break, right? You'll see like look at Apple's chart or whatever. You'll see a big break happen after a cup formation and you'll see a pretty substantial jump to the upside. Like for example, if the cup depth is like, I don't know, like, for example, Luna's cup depth was like from $23 to like $5, let's say. That difference between $23 to $4, that difference would be the expected upside after a breakout of prior high as a nominal effect, right? So that's why.
So is a retest like a reverse cup and handle? Like if you break an all-time high and you get a retest, is that like in a sense, is that like a reverse cup and handle?
Sort of, yeah. But a retest of a long-term high is not a good sign. Like if you think about it, like, okay, so for example, when people say, okay, Bitcoin's going to go back to 20,000 again, right? If Bitcoin goes back to 20,000, we're basically fucked. And the reason why is because if BTC goes back to 20,000, that would imply that all the other price action above 20,000 was just noise and just pure speculation because it couldn't even hold 20K. So if it goes below 20K, like only God knows where it goes after that, right?
Right.
So you better hope it does not go below
20,000. But on a shorter time frame, like the 40K, you know, like, or like I didn't mean to spook everyone. I was talking about like other time frames, but like you see a lot of like it breaks an all-time high and then it retests the all-time high and then it actually moves up. And a lot of people trade the retest instead of like right at the break.
Sure. Like if you're trying to be capital conservative with your money, right? You're like, okay, I'm going to wait for another entry before I buy more again. And one of those entries is going to be if it like tests all time high again. And then you could go down that route. Now, the best assets in the world though don't do a lot of all-time high retests. I'll give you an example. So like BTC going from like I think it was like $1,200 to $20,000, and then on the bottom it hit like 3K, right? It would have been not so good if it went back to $1,000 again, because it just implies that, you know, all that other price action was pure speculation and the hodlers hadn't increased and the adoption hadn't really increased. People just sort of like the price just was an illusory sort of like auction bid price and that was the end of it. So, you know, you in the really, really high quality, high adoption level assets like BTC, Luna's demonstrating that. What you want to see is like a trading range, like for example, Bitcoin between, let's say $100 to $1,200, and then the retrace down to like $150, like over that next year. Like what you want to see is that the next level is way higher than the previous, like exponentially higher. And then you want to see it settle in at a level that is still exponentially higher than your prior level. You follow me? So your trading range, you just never go back to that again. Like it would be like saying, like, let's go back to
You'd rather see it just smash it and like rock it through.
Yeah, like if you were to say, let's go back to pre-split Apple prices and let's see if it'll retest the bottom again, right? You'd be fucking insane, right? Like there's no if that happened.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
It means Adam is, it would mean that Apple is totally in the dirt, right? It just, something really, really bad happened is what you'd have to imply from that. So you don't want to have price like retest, you know, like when people say, oh yeah, like, you know, Luna's going to retest $10 again. If Luna retests $10 again, it's literally fucked. Because
well, this is like a retest from the upside. Like, not to interrupt, but to explain it. Like this all sounds, you're totally like, this is really good information. But I've noticed a lot of times on the break of an all-time high, my cat's like, sorry, one second. My cat's destroying my foot right now. So like on a break of an all-time high, you'll notice, and I think this comes in the self-fulfilling prophecy thing. Like, you'll notice it'll break and then it'll come back down and it'll test the all-time high as like a support and then it'll move up. And like, I've never known if this is like algorithm trading and stuff as well, because like everyone's expecting these moves.
Well, part of why the all-time high break happens is a lot of times people take leverage long positions there. Keep in mind. So if there's a lot of leverage in the system, right, then that can actually liquidate down to the downside back to the prior high.
Right. Okay.
So you don't want to see that happen. You don't want to see retests of all time highs.
Because that's like people deleveraging also. Like
yeah, it means all you got was like existing gamblers, but you didn't actually add any new adoption, right? So that's not
totally
as good
sense.
Of a yeah, that's not as good of a feature when you're doing that kind of retest. But like, for example, in look at Ethereum as an example. So Ethereum was it actually went to like what, 1400, and then I think its low was like $70 like back in 2018 or 2019. I'm losing my mind now, but anyway, but like it had a really big retrace. Why did it do that? It did that because like Ethereum didn't have any real adoption behind it, right? It didn't have anything that you would use it for. It didn't have any yield. It just was basically useless. It was just like, okay, I own Ethereum now, and I'm a fan of Vitalik, and you know, it's awesome. And we're going to reprogram the world with this shit, right? That's how the mindset was. So it had this really big pump, but it actually never had either the initial velocity of Luna, nor did it have the staying power after that large pump. It just wasn't ready as an asset. And what part of, I think, Ethereum's like glory was it was sort of Bitcoin's glory just spilling over into that. And it was sort of like, I don't know, it was kind of a mess.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that. Like this bear market, I've been hearing a lot of like real OG, like devs saying that like they've been actually waiting for this opportunity for a very, very long time to like launch projects, because like this is the right time to do it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So yeah, that the psychology of the market's always kind of crazy, and but you know, the thing is, I think the part of the reason why bear markets happen is because like people let up on talking about crypto when they shouldn't let up, right? Like that. So it's a self-fulfilling problem, whereas the industry fucked themselves essentially, and really, quite frankly, the media did too. Like most people just didn't understand what Bitcoin was. Like if you watch CNBC or something like that, and 26 or 2017, like you came out thinking like, okay, this is a like coin for criminals, and like, okay, Mt. Gox happened, and like all these things occurred, and it's just like a, you know, weird cyberpunk like you know, speculation train, and it's just nonsense, right? That's all a scam. It's like a Ponzi. You know, we recommend you, like, I remember Shamath coming on and some other people like, well, you should probably own one Bitcoin. I'm like, fuck that. One Bitcoin. Like, it's just ridiculous. But anyway, like, that's how they would talk. Like, well, maybe you should own half of one and see what happens as part of your portfolio. And, you know, this kind of thing. But nobody really wanted to say anything really, like, particularly bullish. There were a few guys out there doing that. But
same thing. Like, you should only own 1%. Like, it's just okay, just a little bit.
1% of your portfolio, right? That was kind of what the thinking was. Where it should have been 99%, actually. Fastest growing asset in the human race. And that was the dumbest fucking financial advice of all time. Like, is it like literally all time?
Thanks, Buffett.
Like, yeah, exactly. So basically, yeah, that was an interesting sort of like problem where the media was really, really bad at sort of like analyzing what Bitcoin was, which is actually strange because there was plenty of information out there. So that's when I really started really getting a feel for how lazy and stupid the financial media really is. I mean, like, I think a lot of people knew that ahead of time, but I'm not sure I fully believe them. Like, I'd still watch financial news.
You want to believe in the better nature of things, you know?
Exactly. You want to believe they know what they're talking about because they have a fucking channel called the Business Channel, and they have a thing, you know? And so therefore, like, they must have like some knowledge of foresight that you and me don't have. Like, we must be idiots or something. But they were wrong so many times about so many things when it comes to financial news. Like,
just like, constantly, just always.
Yeah. Yeah. See, like, the financial news loves to talk about something when it's down or when it's up, and then like claim that they, you know, are the wizards of why it went up and down.
And they're just preying on psychology, mind you.
I don't know what, like, they're preying on. I think they're
preying on psychology. Like, when people are fearful, they're so susceptible. So, like, right when people are fearful and they're looking for an answer is when all the crazy stories come out, because they're like, I got to find a reason that this shit's happening, you know? And like, that's always
definitely true. It makes for good, like, when you're trying to connect the dots. You're like, oh yeah, there's the anchor reserve, and oh yeah, like, there's this
scam.
Yeah, like, it's conveniently connects the dots. So obviously, you know, because most people still Google for their information, right? They don't, like, you know, they have no idea what's really going on. They're like, okay, let's Google this. Why is Luna's price down?
Because, you know, my friends who are like not in Terra are like, what is happening? Oh my god!
Right, like, you said it was going to do this, and look at it did that. Yeah, there's a connect the dots mentality that when something's going down, you people tend to Google it. And I'm sure all of us have done this at one level or the other. And like, I talk about this a lot because I do this for a living, but like, it's the same story with like viruses and pandemics, right? Like, when people want to like research this shit, they go Google it. And it's like,
I really hope nobody's Googling, why is Luna going down?
Exactly. Oh my God. No, you know they are, though. Go look at Google Trends and you'll see.
Oh my God. Don't do that. Nobody.
Go type in Google price or something like that and you'll see how it's trending.
And terrifying. Yeah,
for sure. That's what people do. They figure that, like, you know, Uncle Google with all the different news articles are legit, right? And the news articles, all they're trying to do is they go on Twitter and they're like, what are people, like, they'll do, how, you know, $Luna, and they'll say, what are people saying about Luna? Oh, this guy said that something about the anchor reserve, right? So that emerges as a like news article. That was like a tweet like a week ago. And it becomes a news article on fucking Cointelegraph or somewhere. It's ridiculous.
I think if you saw the rise of Google, you understand this like a lot better than people understand it now.
So anyway, yeah, there's a lot of interesting ways that the psychology plays out. But also, there's been in the crypto space, like, rampant news media manipulation too, right? So when these things go down, there are actual control rooms of fucking market makers, or not, or whatever. You can call them manipulators, call them whatever the fuck you want. But the point is, what they do is they go and they'll say, either do a mixture of like feeding certain news agencies like the news, like, to make, you know, to really flood it. But you'll see this, part of it is just human nature. Like, if you go on StockTwits as an example, where people will just show up when it's trending. So if the price is down, people show up and all these bears show up and just like, where'd you come from? Like, out of nowhere, like, they'll start posting. So some of them are truly manipulating in the sense that they have an open short position and they're trying to get all the followers on that coin to like sell. So that's part of it. So in other words, just natural, you know, normal people doing this. And then there's like a whole sequence of bots that emerge, like, you'll see from different, like, quote unquote, news sources and like trading algorithm, like, all sorts of crap happens where, like, when the price moves really high or really low, you'll have all these automated advertisements show up. And those advertisements will go to the latest quote unquote news on Terra. And of course, when the price is down, you know, they're going to pick some other news.
And the algorithms just feed on it and just like gorge themselves.
Yeah, it's just a mixture of human nature and like clickbaiting and all that. So I don't know that, you know, it's not always like a conspiracy so much as it is just a cyclical, like, you know, way people and computers,
it's like marketing
together.
Almost like the algorithms pick up like the increase in like a term being said, and then it just like takes storm from there.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's an interesting play on how this whole thing works. But
Illyria, we're gonna keep talking, by the way, if you want
Illyria,
to jump
go
in.
Ahead. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, hi, no worries. I just wanted to like pivot a little bit.
Yes.
I've been listening. I think it's been very insightful. Like, I'm gonna give TA more of a shot now. But I'd love to hear more about your macro perspective. Like, do you subscribe to any cyclical theory? Like, where do you think we are and how much all of this is being affected by the health of traditional markets? and like governmental legislation.
Are you talking about Luna specifically or just like in general, like crypto?
I think I'm like more curious about like your general view, but also how that impacts how you weigh like Luna in your portfolio.
So from a general macro perspective, what I find is that the macro world, which oftentimes includes like financial media, it includes whoever. The point is the macro world leads to a lot of news articles, generally speaking, and they love to tie the price of Bitcoin to that all the time. Like they just do it, like they've been doing it for so many years, it's just gotten old. So, you know, is there a really good correlation with like actual macro events and like what happens to the price of Bitcoin? I would say the most clear-cut example of large-scale events affecting Bitcoin's price, Mt. Gox was one of them. And that was like not really macro so much as it is like affected Bitcoin world. And then the second major one that was really, really like apparent was the pandemic dump, which led to a mixture of like stocks and equities falling. It led to Bitcoin miners essentially and pools having to sell because they were expecting to shut down BTC mining due to pandemic concerns and yada, yada, yada. So those are sort of like the two, I think, event-driven, most obvious cases. Aside from that, like if when you try to incorporate like some idea that maybe Bitcoin's heavily affected by externalities, it's just not clear that it is. Like if you think about it, like number one, it's still the most, it's like one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing asset of all time. So to say that it really correlates with a whole lot of anything with any degree of certainty is really tough to say. So what do I think is going to happen with sort of like, you know, where BTC price action is going to go? I think number one, we've probably already double bottomed, if I had to guess, on BTC price or getting close to it. Like I mentioned before, I think the odds we're going to head back to 20K are low because there's just so many buyers there now. The second thing is just like we are now, just imagine like, okay, so think about cell phones as a good example, smartphones in particular. Like, would you have expected necessarily major macroeconomic events to necessarily have like, I guess, pushed down the adoption of smartphone growth necessarily? Not really, because they're so extraordinarily useful that they almost created the macroeconomic environment, right? It's the other way around. So I you know, now granted, we didn't have any major economic collapse between like, you know, 20, I would say, by collapse, I mean like Armageddon. We didn't have anything between major between 2000 and 2020 that would prevent the production of these things. But as an adoption cycle, I think what happens in something like crypto is it can actually exceed substantially the performance of all other markets. So as an example, Luna right now is exceeding the performance of practically all markets if you look at the last 1 year, right? Like there's almost no correlation to like what the macroeconomic situation is doing. So I think when it comes to altcoins, especially those with a high degree of like ultra utility, like we talked about like Luna, there's some discussion earlier today about how Thorchain may have similar characteristics. You look at things like the network effect of Bitcoin. Ethereum's faltered a bit just because of speed and like it's been hard to add new users. So they've had a massive hiccup for probably the next year because they can't add people that want to use small amounts of transactions. The only thing they can do is get ETH buyers who want to buy on, like, in other words, a discount ETH buyer or a retail ETH buyer may be able to buy some on Coinbase or whatever and sit on it. But like most people aren't doing a lot of trading in ETH if they're not particularly wealthy. So that sort of reduces the growth. So like, I think the crypto space, I still follow, I think what Willy Woo says is probably the most accurate, which is BTC is basically following adoption level mathematics. And so is the remainder of the crypto space. And what that usually looks like is it's a saturation event that takes something like maybe another 10 years where all the world is using some form of crypto or the other. And until that happens, you still have just a crazy growth phase ahead of us. We haven't even, quite frankly, seen the big jump in BTC price like gold had back when ETFs first came out. which was like a 5x on gold, right? So that's how it got to like the $10 trillion market cap, which includes like derivatives, paper gold, and a bunch of other garbage. But similarly, BTC can do that same maneuver. Along with it, I think Luna, which is essentially a money printer, has higher growth velocity than both Ethereum and Bitcoin ever did by a substantial margin. And I think that's a mixture of the amount of leverage available today in the world. It's a mixture of, you know, Anchor Protocol, you know, offering it right on chain. It's a mixture of the fact that Luna just literally prints money and is hyper deflationary. So every aspect of it is just wicked. As for Luna, I still consider it to be potentially the fastest growing asset in the history of the human race, literally of all time, of every technology there ever was. Luna could beat it all, and it's on that trajectory now. So my conviction for Luna is like extreme, if there ever was one. And I've been in BTC a long time, Apple a long time, MasterCard, Visa, everything I've ever picked is all mooned and done extraordinarily well in network effects. So like what people talk about now in terms of network effects is pretty much all of the only things I ever really invested any serious money in. So it's sort of like it's my thing to look for exponential shit. And I think, that's what brought me into like Terra and got me more excited about it. But, yeah, like any other specific, like macro kind of theory that you're worried about, like inflation and such, I guess you're assuming.
Yeah, I guess like I'm wondering like how governmental regulation is going to play in, because I don't think like US regulation is going to be particularly favorable. But I don't know how much of an impact that can actually have on the macro scale, whether that's going to actually be really bad on the crypto market or it's just going to phase like Americans out of it.
I don't think, well, first off, it's actually not that easy to like regulate yourself out of crypto in the United States, because there's a fairly high proportion in the United States of sort of libertarianism. There is a fairly high proportion of that both on the Democrat and Republican side of the aisle in terms of the US. So any kind of really draconian regulation would have already occurred if it was going to. So I think that's sort of not my worry at this point. I think regulation is going to be more related to how they, you know, get involved more deeply with exchanges, what they might say about decentralized exchanges and this sort of thing. But at the end of the day, like the reality is, they're not going to control anything. Like the United States government, or for that matter, any government on this planet today, like has a hard time tying its own shoelaces as far as I'm concerned. And I deal with a lot of agencies and what have you. Like they're like the idea that they're going to somehow like sort this all out. I still think that the entire economic regime of the planet is going to change. And what's going to happen is with the mixture of Web 3.0, similar to how smartphones like permeated the planet, and everyone sort of uses one now, including politicians, by the way, and governments and whoever, it'll be no different with crypto. It'll just be a technology that everyone just uses. The government will use it. Agencies will use it. Doesn't matter who it is. Like everyone will just simply using it on some level, at which point, like, you know, how you regulate it becomes somewhat moot, but it really becomes a question of taxation, and whether or not even current regimes of taxation can actually continue the way that they are, which really are quite fair, unfair to the retail investor anyway. So probably it's time to wreck that entire damn thing, honestly. So I think the entire planet is about to change over the next decade when it comes to this. So I'm not as worried about the macro or regulatory environment in that sense. I think we will actually dictate what that turns into ultimately.
Awesome. Yeah. I did not notice how deep rooted your conviction was. I'm actually curious.
So,
how much percentage of your portfolio do you have in Luna? Like if you're willing to disclose.
At now it's like getting close to, I guess, like maybe 10%.
Okay.
But then again, I've like, and that's quite a lot, quite frankly, but like at the same time, my BTC chunk is much bigger still. Because I don't sell it, like some of my older stock things like Apple and whatnot just sit there, like it's just I just don't need to sell them really, like so I don't really worry about them. But so I treat all new assets as essentially a sort of brand new project and have fun with it from the very beginning, like I was a kid again, basically. That's kind of how I look at it. So I don't really think about it like, oh, I'm going to go and sell that. I'm going to go buy this. I just sort of like, just keep going. Because I think when you think you're too rich, what happens is you don't, your mindset changes to where like the small things don't matter anymore. And what happens is, like the small things are what do matter. That's how you know how markets work, how people think, what products need to be built. And that's how what keeps you like in the game as far as intuition, as far as what matters and what's going to really grow and what isn't. So I don't think it's a good idea to like, hey, look, I'm going to retire because I made crypto money. Like if I could have retired at the age of 20, probably just all things considered, like, you know, and I'm in my late 40s now. So, you know, you know, there's any number of reasons I could have just like retired if money was all that mattered, right? So, I've been at this quite a while, and yeah, like my crypto conviction is such that, you know, like Vitalik, like a lot of the other people that you know think that smart contracts and like crypto systems are going to change the world, they really are going to change the world because obviously once you've used sort of DeFi, you're like, well, like, why would I use a bank again, right? You're the moment you use DeFi, you're like, okay, when can my bank become made obsolete, right? You're thinking, wait, how do I get a debit card or something connected to this? How do I? And then you're thinking, wait, how do I eliminate MasterCard and Visa entirely, right? So, because they're not needed either, technically. So, I don't hold any of those either anymore. It's probably maybe a bad financial choice, but I sold those because I think they'll be made obsolete ultimately. I just don't think they're necessary at all. Like they used to be, but I think they're just obsolete tech at this point that are completely pointless now. Like we just pay a massive like tax as consumers to Visa and MasterCard, and those like processing agencies at the rate of like 2-2.5%, you know, as businesses, and like that has to end at this point. Like the usual state tax in like the United States for taxes is like, you know, a lot of states have taxes at the like 8% level and, you know, that, you know, 5% level, those kind of numbers. To have Visa and MasterCard charge 2% for everything is obnoxious, right? Like it's just literally a tax that one or two or three companies is like taking up for the entire country. And like, you know, and then essentially every single person in the United States should be a Visa or MasterCard stockholder or just not like shop, like because it makes no sense. Otherwise, right? Because you're basically being taxed for that money anyway. You might as well just like gain in the growth of it. That's kind of what my thinking was when I bought the IPOs of Visa and MasterCard as examples. But
yeah.
So like anything that I actually use, like I tend to own a fair amount of stock in, like oil and natural gas and whatever. Anything that like I feel like I have to buy, like I should own part of that as part of a portfolio, because like then I can make money off of the like growth of that, as opposed to just me paying for gasoline all the time and then like I don't get anything back, right? So it's like that's how I think about it a little bit, is the things that you use are the things that you probably other people are going to use and therefore going to retain value over time. So I have a fairly narrow set of things that I own for the most part, mostly high conviction types of assets, and really among them, you know, so like right now, as far as you know, Terra is concerned, the number of catalysts for Terra's growth are just so enormous. Like it just reminds me of the days when, like, you know, like Steve and Woz were sitting in their garage and whatnot, making me Apple computers to play with them when I was a kid. And you know, like it's amazing how much like innovations, you know, come out of Terra, the tokenomic plan. Like the strategy is really, really impressive so far. And you know, like there's an element where DeFi is sort of like you're buying into decentralization, but you're sort of not. You're sort of buying into the teams that build it. Yeah, there's some voting involved and whatnot, but you need to have something to vote for and then something to build it on the other end once you vote for it, right? So at the end of the day, like the question is who's gonna be doing that work and who are the teams building them? Are the protocols that are coming out looking world changing, like Prism that we're about to open up on, I think in the next hours. Yeah, Prism basically is, I think a really DeFi defining DApp at this point. And I'm not telling you buy the coin or not buy the coin, so like don't go blame me if it goes up or down. But basically, you know, the more I was sort of like looking at what Prism does and how I might use it, like I, you know, you can find probably a half dozen to a dozen different strategies of things you can do with that system that can affect like every element of crypto space, from NFTs to, I don't know, volatility trading to, you know, just yield optimization, all sorts of different reasons why you might like play that game. But it's those kinds of unique things that like the more of them that come out, the more bullish I tend to be, because those are things that not only that, well, I look at it as a two-tiered thing. Like one is you want to have systems that lock up UST or have utility for UST. On the flip side, you want to have systems that make it more valuable to hold Luna and lock that up, right? Because both directions cause Luna's price to go up ultimately. And, you know, then you have to ask yourself, well, are these bullshit reasons why people would lock up these things, or do they have real serious utility? The UST side is obvious because, you know, its use as a transactional currency, and for that matter, fees on the Terra network, both are amazing utilities just by themselves. And of course, the use in Anchor Protocol and in the future in Mars and in Kinetic Money and some of these protocols are awesome too, of course. But then the Luna utilities, the number one utility being that it generates non-inflationary yield, is super powerful just by itself. Like there's no amount of Luna that you can own that doesn't make sense that you shouldn't own more at any price at this point. Because really you're talking about like with a non-inflationary yield, that's one of the few cryptos, or maybe the only crypto in DeFi that is able to sustain a non-inflationary yield. And even if it's not 8-9%, even if it was 4 or 5%, it'd still be amazing as a non-inflationary yield from the fees of the network. So that makes it sustainable. That makes it a reason to hold Luna. And then other things like auto-compounding strategies, like Stator has, or what Prism's doing, all of these things make it even more likely that you're going to own Luna. Not to mention you can borrow off your Luna, which is a fantastic utility just by itself, right? That you can't do that with altcoins. So I could go into KuCoin and go and just buy a bunch of junk. But then can I stake it? Can I borrow off it? Are there any actual utilities for it to optimize like my strategies? And most things don't help you with that, right? Like, for example, what did I do with Luna this last week, right? So Luna took a massive nosedive. So I bought more and then I borrowed off of it immediately so that I could buy more, like, you know, in the $40 to $50 range. So, you know, how many coins do I have that I can do that with such instantaneous speed? So that kind of ability to manipulate your money quickly is really, really, I think, really important, and a reason why I prefer to hold Luna versus almost all other crypto for that reason. Like it's just too malleable and too like productive of an asset that I can just make more money with more money, right? It's just weird, but it's just, yeah, it's pretty magical. I haven't seen an asset ever really. And that includes like playing on exchanges and doing different things that I felt more comfortable falling asleep with than with Luna's price going up and down. I couldn't, like, it's going to go up, I almost for sure. You know, I can be almost sure of that. So I like it in a lot of different reasons. Jason, you want to hop on?
Yeah, what's up, CFI?
Hey.
Hey, so I was reading that sponsorship proposal, and I thought one of the coolest pieces of it is they're going to allow for UST spending inside of the venues and the stadium. And I'm curious, you were just talking about, you know, the usefulness of UST, and I'm just curious how you see this playing out. Like, I know you're a fan of Voyager as well, so are you just thinking that people are going to be spending UST or USDC? Like, basically, you'll just the processing at the transaction level or at the point of sale is just going to convert it into a USD value. Is that how this is going to end up?
Yeah, there's these different, like, so I think the first, or one of the first crypto companies to go into sports was this last year, I mean, was StormX. And that's like Simon Yu's little company. It's like a discount shopping coin. And they signed up with the Portland Trailblazers to do, like, I think a 5-year deal And on their jerseys, there's a little logo and whatnot. And I think it's more just a straight marketing deal. I believe it's just a jersey deal. I don't know if there's anything else too fancy than that. So that was one sort of tie up. Then with Voyager and the Mavericks, what they did was, well, Mark Cuban already like did a thing where he rode the Dogecoin wave and said, hey, we'll accept Dogecoin for Mavericks tickets. I don't even know where you do that. Maybe on their website or something. That seemed like just a mostly like a publicity stunt because people were buying a lot of, you know, Dogecoin's price was up and people are doing searches, and he just sort of rode that wave. Then like Voyager approached Cuban about doing like a 5-year tie-up for marketing for them, to where like the Voyager brand name for the exchange is going to be like all over the like arena in I guess in Dallas mainly when they're in like when they're playing there. And then there's going to be some other interesting tie-ups, like I don't know if you're going to go like pay for Mavericks tickets via the platform or something, who the hell knows. So that's that one. And then with, yeah, if they're going to bring UST, then the question is like, how are they accepting it? Are they going to accept it like through some new app that gets built? You know, so let's say it's a basketball brand and they sort of like, you know, or a baseball brand or something like the Yankees or whatever. And let's say they decide, okay, well, we're going to have an app that basically will allow you to tie into Terra UST and you can somehow like make transactions there. That'd be pretty cool. But I don't know how that's going to look. Like, how is that integration going to happen? But the interesting thing is with that is that TFL has obviously the know-how to make all that happen, right? So
yeah, one of the problems with Chai, right? I mean, Chai is sort of a
exactly. Maybe they can bring that expertise in. But basically, yeah, the reality is that right now, crypto developers are hard to come by. And, you know, when you walk up to a team and say, hey, look, let's do an integration partnership, we'll sort of build out a little platform for you. And, you know, now you can get paid in this and we can get visibility as Terra, blah, blah, blah. You know, it could be a pretty it could be really good, you know, because once you build that out once, right, once you've spent that money one time to do it, it doesn't take that much to do that for lots and lots of other companies. Right. So that's kind of how I kind of foresee that playing out. If they do it that way, they'd want to make that tech capable of spreading to like maybe all the basketball teams or whatever, right? That would make a lot of sense.
Well, and I think that's like the outlet debit card and the Alice card, like all these different payment cards are going to essentially let you buy stuff everywhere. So it's not like, you know, the stadium with the credit card reader when you buy a hot dog or whatever. Like, it's not going to, if you're just using a credit card, you really aren't changing the way that people pay for things. It's just the pot of money that it gets paid for through.
Yeah, like Alice or whatever just goes through like Prime Trust and then they pay fiat to the vendor. But you want the vendor to accept UST direct and eliminate MasterCard and Visa in the middle, right? So that actually would save, in theory, if you actually get all your fans to use that, it would actually save the fans money because they might be making some money on Anchor Protocol. But also it could save the company money because they're not having to pay MasterCard and Visa transaction fees anymore, right? So there's all that too. Yeah.
I think it might be it might be a play for the point of sale hardware manufacturers like Square. Cause I mean, then it's really just a software update to now we just accept UST. Right.
Yeah, that's gonna be the big shift is, can you add say, for example, UST acceptance to existing hardware and not necessarily add it, have a new device. But you know what? Even if it was a new device, I mean, damn, like you could probably create a device that accepts UST, like a physical piece of hardware that you could probably sell for like $5. I mean, like literally, like it's the stupidest piece of hardware. Like, not much is required to build a hardware like system. So I, you know, but that's not to say that like every company is going to want to integrate that into their payment system, right? Like, it's a pain in the ass to deal with multiple types of, you know, payments. So if you own a business and deal with like payment processors and everything, it is kind of a nuisance to have to integrate different things. But
let me
get Ryan on real quick since he was waiting. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was, when I first saw this, I went nuts. Like, this is gonna be so cool. It's a stadium sponsorship, jerseys, team, all this. But the more I read into it, it's it sounds like it's really just like a club or a premium club, like a very like potentially small portion of the stadium, and then a bunch of signage and videos and banner ads and such. And then the payment thing doesn't seem like that's a lock as far as like the stuff that we're kind of dreaming up here of like
right
throughout the entire venue. It seems like their partnership is really only limited to this club, and like, you know, I've seen them in some of these stadiums where that's like the kind of a penthouse spot or kind of a premium corner.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, like I'm not sure how.
Yeah,
of course the price tag, like 40 million is big, but it's not big enough to be like a, you know, full stadium takeover, I don't think. So
yeah, I don't remember how much StormX and Voyager paid exactly for that similar kind of 5-year sort of partnerships.
Well, crypto.com paid $700 million for Staples. So that, I mean, that's what it said in the proposal, that we essentially purchased the second highest rated thing that you can behind the naming rights of the entire venue.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I don't know what the absolute highest impact sort of advertising theory is, by the way, as far as, you know, like it did take Bitcoin forever because it didn't have some sort of concerted effort. But at the same time, if you think about it, these represent sort of like centralization issues. Because now, like you're dealing with, like you said, you're dealing with basically like a DAO. Like, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about the idea of like using the money for this purpose, but I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. And is the DAO maybe a bigger news? Like, was there a DAO?
No. What he means to say is like, we're essentially a de facto DAO because we have a community fund and then we have like voting, right? So like, that's what that is.
But is this the first time they've kind of referred to themselves as a DAO?
Yeah, I mean, he just says, like, if you think about it, it's just it's a very big DAO, given that we have one of the biggest community pools in the world, like, in crypto right now, right? So that's kind of where that, you know, he just sort of, like, called that. Because usually you don't think of, like, a traditional voting crypto, like, doing, like, basketball advertising, right? So it starts to become more like a more traditional organization in that respect. So I don't know, like, when Doe says these things, like he says like slightly different messages. Like sometimes he's like, yeah, I'm just going to disappear one day and I'm going to like, this is all going to be decentralized. And other times now we're talking about like advertising. So I don't know which way we're going. So we'll see.
Ton of big hires too.
What's that?
There's been a lot of big hires at TFL too. I mean, they're adding some, you know, extra councils and.
Yeah.
I mean, people are leaving pretty big TradFi jobs to join them. So, I mean, if it's a company you're invested in, like Apple, you know, it's good to see talent flowing there.
Yeah, like that's the thing. I'm not as worried about decentralization, like necessarily. As long as the platform is decentralized, you want to have someone helming some great innovation at the top, in my opinion. That's where most of the big money in the world has ever been made. So I don't know. We'll see. Lucky, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I wanted to touch upon your last comment around the point of sale. So I've been in IT and corporate America for about 15 years for a multi-billion dollar retailer. Mm-hmm. And stores has been a spot that I've spent a lot of time at. And, you know, I've been trying to push, I don't want to dox myself. So I've been trying to push our company to adopt the blockchain for just gift cards itself. Okay, so that's kind of the first route that I've been trying to get to. And it's interesting because if you don't ride the rails of the payment processors, then you're essentially just having the user give a QR code to scan or not. So the UST comment has been really, I've been really thinking about it lately. Like, how do I present, and I'm curious, Steffi, what your thoughts are, is like, what would be the benefit for, you know, a multi-billion dollar retailer to jump on the train of UST and utilize it at a store? Is it for just the people that are using the crypto, or would we be able to kind of, well, what would the use case be there? Because I'm trying to figure out how to discuss it.
The most obvious change that happens when you go to accepting UST direct, the number one most obvious is transactional fees come down a lot, especially when it comes to any sort of like larger ticket items. proportionally the transaction fee is not scaling. It doesn't scale, so you don't have a higher fee. Like, it's not like ETH gas fees. You know, you're going to buy a, you know, like a, you know, I don't know, a car, and so therefore now you have to pay way more in fees than if you were to buy like a bicycle. Your UST transactional fees on the network are fairly low, so that would be an important feature. The second would be just the fact that with like MasterCard and Visa, you pay a lot now anyway, right? You pay, if you're any subscription business, for example, and you're losing like 2% of your like revenue as an expense, that's a lot of money. If you think about it, like, it's just a terrible amount of expense. And every business just assumes if they accept credit cards, they're just screwed for that. And some of the bigger businesses might get better deals. Like, if you're a Walmart or, you know, something like that, you might get a deal with, I don't know, Visa or MasterCard, and they cut you a better rate or something like that. Excuse me, I got hiccups. But the credit card fee piece of the puzzle, I think, is where a large organization would get some benefit. Now, in order to realize that benefit, that would imply, of course, that the consumer has like an easy way,
right?
Yeah, an easy way to use UST.
I think the way that I've been thinking about it, and just hear me out for a second, is gift cards cost a lot for an organization. Okay, you have to typically buy the card, you have to go through a processor to handle it. There's a lot of things behind the scenes. If the blockchain can be adopted for a gift card, for an on-ramp for an organization, you know, especially my size that I work for, that's kind of the first step to getting people onto the platform. And UST, you know, if we could, that'd be awesome. Like, integrate like a UST piece of to it, right? And then from there, I mean, then it opens up the door that are endless.
Yeah, no question. I mean, like, it's easy to imagine almost everything that needs to be done. It's that like catalyst that ends up causing it to be done, because there's no technical limitation whatsoever, right? Like, it's just simply a matter of implementation. It's about development, and like, it's about a company that ends up having the vision to go that route, almost more than anything else. And they would just think about it as a payment rail ultimately. Even if they don't need to like mess with Anchor Protocol, they don't need to do anything else. They're just interested as a payment rail. It'd still be worth it, I think.
Can I jump in real quick?
And there, by the way, there's some companies that do things like this. Now Payments takes a lot of different crypto and sort of facilitates the vendor being paid in crypto or in USD. There's also like Payments on Terra is actually a site also that is working on things like that, where your business can like accept online payments. I don't know how advantageous those are right now in terms of fee structure and whatnot. And that's the other thing. When you build out these things, part of what MasterCard and Visa are charging you for is a massive payments network that's already sort of established, right, all over the world. So, and they're also like making money because all the customers have either MasterCard or Visa or some like subset of that. And that allows the merchant to get access to a customer that can pay with that strategy with a high degree of certainty, or pretty much everybody these days. Getting past that, those monopolies, is going to be the hard part.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was part one of a two-part CeFi space, Prism, Sports, Liquidations, and FUD, recorded on Monday, January 31st, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by Orbital Command, a community validator on Terra dedicated to educating, expanding, and promoting the Lunatic community. Take advantage of their Terra Luna Intel report on Telegram, which brings you the hottest news and updates on all things Terra each and every day. Find it using the link in the show notes. You can also support their community efforts by considering them next time you're delegating or redelegating your Luna. Find out more at orbitalcommand.io. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by Luart. Luart is the first gamified NFT platform built on the Terra network. Luart provides a seamless minting and trading experience, all while earning you rewards just for being a user. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the community in Discord for the most up-to-date news and announcements regarding all the hot new NFT launches, platform upgrades, and new projects hitting the secondary marketplace. Are you ready to put your helmet on and join the movement? Find out more at luart.io. TerraSpaces appreciates the support of all our sponsors. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening.
When we blow through the dust, volcanoes erupt. No one ever guessed that the game would be tough. Keep it hands off when the play is a bust. Plain old and just, so we keep it on the one. Blast off on the two, help me see the three. Third eye open wide, checking out the scene. Laser beam focused, Starscream jokers. Living off the fat of the people they approach. Tell me what happens when the land fights back. With the cliffs at our backs, make the last stand matter. No one ever planned for the famine on deck. We was walking all a wreck with a dead man swagger. Sitting in a little den, envisioning the middlemen. Listen to the fiddle man play a little ditty, then talk about how all the leaders seem reptilian. Lost in the maze, trying to make the next billion. Talk about how all the leaders seem reptilian. Lost in the maze, trying to make the next billion. In a little den, envisioning the middlemen. Listen to the fiddle man play a little ditty, then talk about how all the leaders seem reptilian. Lost in the maze, trying to make the next bill. No one gave a shit till the drugs all dried up. Everybody died from a bad batch of Lysol, but it didn't matter. We was all hyped up when the pedal lit the metal. He just didn't have the right skill. Watched in the daytime till the night curfew. Rats in a cage till they make time to murk you. Got a little job that falls under my purview. We gotta get this mob away from the bird's view. Gotta find cover, wipe off the bird poop. Write off the work while you try on the worst juice. Blinded by perps who try to reverse truth. Slide like Fox News just trying to lie to you. Eating up the slop like a bunch of hungry vagrants. I can't wait for the day they lock us up in stasis. Mock up a basement, could call me resilient. Waiting for the internet to make me a billion. Then envision in the middlemen. Listen to the fiddle man play a little ditty, then talk about how all the leaders seem reptilian. Lost in the maze, trying to make the next billion. Talk about how all the leaders seem reptilian. Lost in the maze, trying to make the next billion.
Terra Spaces.